change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host for today, Mickey Desai. Co-hosting with me today is Dave Pauly. Dave is a senior consultant with our fundraising search. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mickey. How are you today?
I'm great, thank you. And our guest for today is Bradley Kirschbaum. Bradley is the founder of the Canopy Project. Did I get that right, Bradley?
You sure did. Thanks, Mickey.
Welcome. And what is the Canopy Project?
The Canopy Project is an idea I started a little over a year ago, and the baseline of it is to assist people who are looking for help from social services by enhancing the services that are already there through software.
By enhancing the services that are already there with software.
That's right. And I have we can enhance different lines of communication, and we can enhance different abilities to acquire basic information that's right now all over the internet or perhaps in somebody's files, but just not all in a centralized location where perhaps you or I or someone who needs the help is the end client who can easily access that kind of information.
Got it. So my devil's advocate / foil question for you is, we're talking about databases. Is that
exactly.
Inadequate? Okay. Yeah.
And the first thing that usually comes up is, well, can't you Google these things? And you really can find a lot of this information when you start looking at the specifics online. Mm-hmm. Or 211 is something everyone's familiar with in the space for calling and getting this information. But everything's so siloed within social services that you're really going city from city, county to county, state by state. Things are different. There's different program managers. And, you know, some people might say it's a bit of a cluster, but there are a lot of ways to untangle that web. And the first place to start is just to put at least the door to information and access that people need all in the same place.
Right. Very good. That in itself is a conversation I think you and I should have on a separate episode of the Snapcast, if you're open for that.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So you had a bunch of questions. When we first met on the phone, you said you had a bunch of questions you wanted to get answered. And I immediately thought of Dave when I saw your list of questions. You want to start us off with the first one?
Of course.
And just to be clear, these are questions related to a certain element of nonprofit management. Isn't that is that where we're going to go today?
We're mostly focusing on other people in the same situation as myself and my volunteer crew, which is being in that first year or two of trying to get the wheels in motion and establish your idea with other individuals to start bringing some momentum to your movement.
Very cool. Then I will hand the ball to you. Take us away.
Thanks, Mickey. So the first one I've got for you, Dave and Mickey, is very simply, is there such a thing as too many cooks in the kitchen when it comes to board members? I've been getting a lot of advice on, you know, who to bring on and what kind of individuals I need to work with and who I'm lacking on the board. But for all intents and purposes, I could find 100 people. So what would keep me from wanting to go big on those numbers?
Excellent question, Dave.
Okay, so let's cut to your chase. You know, is there such a thing as too many cooks in the kitchen? The answer is yes.
Yeah.
But we have to establish a couple of things up front that help you define what the right number is. You got to remember that board members are expected to bring three things to the board: time, talent, and treasure. That they're expected to donate, they're expected to do some element of work, and they're expected to make time for the organization. Now, what's the right size board largely depends on the size of the organization. You know, that the first nonprofit I worked for, had 400 employees, $100 million budget, and we had probably, I think, 80 people on the board. Of those 80 people, 100% of them were donors, probably less than 30% of them were active in terms of giving time and talent. Flip side, the last nonprofit that I ran was significantly smaller and had too many members on the board that they kept falling in front of themselves. I think the starting point really goes to the right size board, goes to your board recruiting strategy. Don't think of it in terms of, you know, I've got to have this many board members or this few board members. Think about getting the right board members in place, because you as an executive director probably haven't learned this yet. A board seat is more valuable vacant than if you fill it with a bad board member.
Right. This actually segues perfectly into question number two for you, which is, should board members have distinctly different expertises or experiences from each other? What I'm looking at is whether or not having 10 people who all really do the same thing, perhaps in their day job or in other nonprofits, are they going to start to bump elbows too much or become a hindrance on actually getting things done if we have, not to use the analogy twice, but too many cooks in the kitchen cooking the same thing?
I'm going to suggest to you that, and I'll again defer to Dave's explanation on this, but the answer is a resounding yes. It helps you to have as much diversity as possible on your board across as many different dimensions as possible, not just socioeconomic status, but obviously we're talking about race, gender identity. We're talking about anything that gives someone to have a uniquely different story and reason to be at the table is someone you want to be talking to. Dave?
Yeah, I'm going to build on what Mickey said, that as a rule of thumb, any organization, the more diversity there are among the members, the better that organization is at making decisions and solving problems, because people bring more perspectives. I lived this. The first nonprofit that I was CEO of was an environmental law firm. I had 17 attorneys on a board of 19 people. I have an entirely new vision of hell that is radically different than what the nuns drilled into my head.
Oh, wow.
And you know, in order to figure out what you need, there are actually tools that you can find on the web. If you look for board diversity matrices, you can find tools that will help you identify what are the skills, abilities, and access that you would like boards to have. And if you know, the starting point is, if you look at your existing board of directors, who do we already have? Put them in the matrix first. Do we have finance people? Do we have attorneys? Do we have social workers? You don't want too many of any one profession or any one socioeconomic demographic group represented there. A matrix like that will help you identify what you're missing on the board, and then it gives your board search or governance committee a shopping list of what they need to go look for.
Exactly.
I'll also give you one other bit of advice that many small nonprofits make in the beginning, mm-hmm. is they recruit financial planners or lawyers onto their board in the belief that those people will, especially financial planners, in the belief that the financial planners will give you access to their clients. That doesn't happen. Actually, that would be a conflict of interest within their own professions, not to mention just bad business on their part. So if you need a financial planner, recruit one. If you need a lawyer, recruit one. But don't do it from the mistaken belief that, oh, they know a lot of rich people and they'll bring donors to the table.
Right. I've also heard that some nonprofits make it a point to recruit a board member from their recipient population. So they get that extra dimension to the number of voices that are at the table or the kinds of messaging that we receive at the table. And frankly, I think that's a brilliant idea.
That's an excellent suggestion. In the last 40 days or so, I've gotten a lot more public with what we're doing with the Canopy Project and kind of promoting online. And the leads have been far more substantial than I thought. And I'm actually speaking with multiple people that have used social services predominantly from a homeless perspective. And some of those people have put amazing knowledge right into my lap that no one else was going to answer because they haven't been on that end of the situation. And I think, you know, there's going to be more than a few people that I would love to invite to be a part of this project with that kind of background and experience. It makes sense.
Sure. Absolutely. What's next, Bradley?
I'll skip number three. It kind of ties into some of the things we've already talked about. So four will be, would you say there's a type of person that should be avoided from being brought onto your board? I know you mentioned the three T's. That was time, talent, and treasure.
Correct.
Perhaps if someone was missing two out of the three, is that kind of an automatic, maybe we should find someone else who fits this situation better?
I don't think so. No. Dave, do you want to take this one?
No, think of it this way. Everyone is going to have different capabilities or capacity in time, talent, and treasure. So many funders, most institutional funders, in order to access grants, you're going to have 100% participation from the board as donors. Now, if you've got a minimum board expectation, you treat it as that expectation. And if it, you know, let's say it's $1,000, if a board member doesn't have the capacity to give $1,000, but can give time or can give access or can give talent, that's great. The board can choose to waive it and say that this board member brings something great to the table. It does mean, however, that you have to be very deliberate in your recruiting of your board members. I do a lot of board governance training, and Mickey has heard me say this before. I'll get in front of a board and start running them through training on how to appropriately govern the organization. And I'll get to slide three, which deals with fundraising. And some board member will always hold their hand up and say, "Oh, Dave, you don't understand. This was never meant to be a fundraising board." And to which I will come back and say, "No, you don't understand. Every board's a fundraising board." That board member is usually not fond of me for the whole rest of the training class. But the reality is there that even if somebody is not giving, you know, as much as other board members, they all have a collective responsibility to ensure that the organization is financially viable. And that can be through volunteering and through access. The way you worded your question, I think, is much more prescient in terms of, is there a type of person who should be avoided from adding to the board? Yes, sociopaths. And I'm being a little glib, but everyone who has ever led a nonprofit has had a truly bad board member. Organizations that are not deliberate with their board members typically wind up with three challenging board members. One is there because they believe that they are there to manage you as the CEO. And that's not their role. Governance is a very different role than managing. So you need board, you want board members that know their lane and understand they're supposed to stay in their lane. The second board member is one that may be passionate about the mission of the organization, or, you know, like the people on the board, or God forbid, likes the parties or the fundraisers, but doesn't really understand, you know, how to lead an organization. It's an unfair characterization, but it's what I call the socialite board member. And then the third board member, which I've not found an appropriate way to describe them except for sociopathic, is the board member who, for their $10 donation, believes that they get to do $100 worth of damage. And, you know, one of the things, having run both for-profit companies and not-for-profit companies are harder to run. But yet, conversely, the standards of board service are much lower for nonprofits than they are for profits. So it's easier to get on a not-for-profit board, and people will get on. And by and large, most boards are going to be people who are compassionate and care about the mission. They're going to be kind people. Those boards are also terrible at standing up to the sociopath. And so being very clear and deliberate, my last company, we accidentally recruited somebody onto the board that everyone said, "Oh yeah, I could have told you he was going to be a problem," which I came back and said, "Then why didn't you tell me it was going to be a problem?"
So let me piggyback on that a few different things. You know, we've talked about, Dave said, bring your time, your treasures, and your talents. I have a slightly less polite way to say that is that a good board member brings they're a doer, a donor, and a door opener. And if they can't be those three things, then they should probably help you find someone who can be those three things. That being said, if you're as you're interviewing new candidates for the board. I like to say that that vetting these people is a little bit like dating. It's kind of trial and error until you realize what works and what doesn't for the organization. And so you're probably going to need to make a little mistakes, but I would also say trust your instincts. And if your gut says this is going to work, then it probably will. And if you have any reservations, then you should listen to those. The characteristics that I personally like to see in board members is finding people who are really good listeners. If they're good listeners, then they're probably not troublemakers in any other meaningful way. That's a maybe an unfair blanket statement on my part, but so far, I think a good listener makes for an ideal board member. And lastly, you know, when it comes time to talk about the fundraising requirement, I don't know if this is still germane to this particular question, but yes, everyone on the board should be a fundraiser, or at least help in the fundraising effort. Everyone on the board should make a significant gift every year. And that's also room for a whole different episode's discussion, I'm sure. But the phrase that I use when talking to boards is, if they have an agreement to raise $1,000 every year, give or get, however they choose to frame it, I'm not a huge fan of those quantified numbers for board fundraising requirements. I do like to say to the individual board member that if they can write their annual check without thinking about it, it's not big enough. and they get mad at me when I say that. It is kind of crass, but the whole job of the board member is to make that organization their chief philanthropic concern for the year. Never mind the whole issue about fiduciary responsibility, which is, you know, hanging over everybody all the time. If they're your chief philanthropic concern for the year, they need to be thinking about what a meaningful contribution to your organization means. And that's simply the truth. Would you agree, Dave?
I would, absolutely. I think the fundraising part gets glossed over a lot, and coming back to governance and it being successful, you can be very, very creative on how a board member gives. I'm on the board of directors of an art center, and my annual gift is not as big as other board members, but I attend everything they do and I buy tickets to everything they put on. And, you know, I buy the art from the students there. That is what you want to expect from board members. You know, it's not just about the check you write. It's about the overall value of the contribution you make to the organization.
Right. I hope that answers your question, Bradley.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys. One more here. Our group, like many other nonprofits, has the daunting task of trying to improve a system that not only is different from state to state, as I was saying, but also can be county to county management. So is there a particular experience in a board member that maybe should be sought out when the group is likely to interact with many municipalities and levels of government if they're going to succeed?
Very good question. I'll defer to you on this one, Dave. Yeah.
You know, it's a very good question on a lot of fronts. Mickey and I have a mutual friend and colleague who is a professional lobbyist. She is looking at her. She is somebody I would want on my board.
Yeah.
Because she knows how to navigate the corridors of power and the corridors of government. And more importantly, because you're talking about so many different municipalities and states, you're not going to find somebody who has an expertise on both Sacramento and Atlanta and the City Council of Fargo.
Right.
But if you've got somebody like Mickey's and my friend Dawn, what she knows how to do is how to pick up the phone and who to call to get the expertise where she doesn't know it. So, and lobbyists are going to be a hard one to get on. I actually would suggest a lobbyist outside of the, you know, necessarily the mental health arena or the arena that the Canopy Project's looking at. Because that skill set and that sense of fearlessness and that ability to network is what makes a lobbyist successful. You know, if you can find one within the vertical, great, but you don't need one because they make their living off of trying to figure out how to navigate government.
And if you can't find anyone with, you know, a dedicated Rolodex like that, I would suggest that finding anyone who's really good at networking. And in my mind, these are sales folks or, you know, development and fundraising related types of folks, people who are used to trying to find a path between point A and point B. Those folks are always useful to have for this kind of thing. To some degree, this kind of stewardship that you're talking about is its own kind of networking effort.
Right. That makes sense as well. I mean, it seems like having constant relationships when it comes to working with municipalities is a pretty tough thing to do, because everyone out there wants a constant relationship or thinks that their effort or movement or whatever their cause is the most important item of the day when you're being thought about for 60 seconds. Right. And it's interesting to see how many times you really have to touch tabs to ensure that someone is paying attention to what you are looking for or trying to get done.
Yep. Right. What else, Bradley? We're not quite out of time yet. So,
yeah. Well, I've listened to about 50 of the podcasts from your recordings now, Mickey.
So and, you're responsible for the spike in my listenership.
Yeah, if you've been paying attention, that's all me for in the last couple of weeks. But
Mickey, you have a groupie.
I love the audience that is paying attention to this and. Particularly the people that are, you know, contributing to this as well. I was going to say that. Mm-hmm. But I guess from your case, you both are working on nonprofits, but you've also gone social, you know, you're promoting ideas and conversation and people. What would be your advice to a nonprofit, not necessarily looking in the areas I'm looking in, but in general to a group that is trying to find better ways to strengthen their brand and their self-promotion? I know right off the bat, it's easy to say, well, if you can do a little fundraising and you've got $500 a month you can spend on advertising or something like that, there's that very brute way of getting it done. But in terms of just growing people's awareness and understanding of you, what are some of the alternatives to simply promoting via advertisement?
Social media gives you many different ways to tell your story. And I don't think there's anything wrong with telling your story over and over again via different channels. You can slice and dice a story several different ways and wring every bit of value that you can out of it. I'm pretty sure I'm not answering your question at this point, but I'll get to it, I swear. In fact, let me just hand the ball to Dave as I put together the rest of my answer here.
Mickey's having a momentary out-of-body experience. I'll be right back. You know, Bradley, so let's start with it from a very tactical fundraising perspective. The art of fundraising for a nonprofit is the art of a relationship. People give to organizations that they feel like they have a relationship with. So social media, any of your marketing channels, however you do it, promote the organization. The goal is not just, hey, we're the Canopy Project, give us money. It was like, hey, we're the Canopy Project, get to know us.
That's it.
You know, build a relationship with them. And, you know, the fundraising relationship, any kind of, with any donor, it's a two-way relationship. You know, the donor gets something out of their relationship with you. And you want to make sure that you honor that and steward that. One of the things, so Mickey and I are also on another podcast together. One of the things that I'll give Mickey a real shout out on in what he does that is, I think, is a model for a lot of nonprofits when you are on the show, it's not about Mickey. It's about the audience or the guest. When you're on our other podcast, it's about the audience and the guest. It's not about us. It's a really good model for social media. It's not about the organization. It's not about, let us tell you how great we are. Let us tell you the stories of the people who support us and the people who we impact. It's a very, that kind of selfless social media model goes a long way in laying the foundation for that relationship. People want to get to know you then, as opposed to if you're an organization that just always talks about yourselves.
Exactly. And the part that I was trying to lead up to earlier was it helps to know your audience or your best guess about your audience, because that helps you tailor your story to them. It's another element of stewardship, right? You have to make sure you're not alienating the people that you're trying to reach via whatever channel you're using. So tell your story, tell it repeatedly, provide quality content that your audience will like to come back and get more of. And at that point, your challenge is sort of twofold or threefold. It's not just telling a good story. It's also sort of gaming the algorithms as they are, and playing the SEO game. So you have a story to tell, but doing it repeatedly helps with SEO, and it helps with gaming the algorithms on social media. And then making sure you tell it the right way so that you're using the right keywords in the right places will also help people find you via organic search as they look for the things that they're interested in. And of course, you know, SEO and algorithm maintenance and all this stuff is its own topic for another day. But again, tell the story, tell it repeatedly, and make sure you're never alienating your audience.
Thanks. Both really great points there. And I can't help but see the parallels to some other business endeavors I have outside of this, where we're using social in those aspects as well. But when it comes to providing value to other people, when you're trying to not just sell someone, but partner with someone and make them see the value in something, there's a lot more resistance there. And there has to be a lot more familiarity and education. And you really have to create an ecosystem. When it comes to something like this, so long as you're clear and concise about what your intent is and what you're doing, people are very willing to help you when you're doing something that's relatively selfless, that is not directly benefiting you. And I think that's the most interesting aspect of really the nonprofit sector in general, is that there is some aspect of I'm doing this because I believe in the movement or what the cause is. And it really creates a different effect within that social, predominantly digitally based social ecosystem, where people are reaching out and looking for your attention all the time. So there's definitely huge differences between trying to sell the world's best t-shirt to everybody online, or, you know, there's a million companies trying to do that, but there's only a few companies that are really trying to help out the people in their neighborhoods and state and what have you. And the reaction is very different to those two things.
Right.
It really is. It's the basics of marketing still apply. The only difference between for-profit and not for-profit in this particular sense is an IRS classification. The same strategies still apply. You still have to bring more in than you spend. This way to engage is critical. If I can use an example for a nonprofit I used to work with that was in the vision space, remember the first time I got there and I saw a social media post with a picture of a diseased eye. And I thought, yeah, who the hell is going to click on this? Yeah. A happy kid in glasses. That's going to get somebody to click through. Not an ulcerated cornea. So you still have to use that same common sense. You're selling a more compassionate product.
Know your audience.
Yep.
I got to say too, David, with a little over a year of paying attention to this idea and putting energy into it, the idea of just starting a nonprofit and having a good time or making things happen and move along, you know, if you're not coming into this with a business mindset or the same principles that you are starting a business, this, you know, if you want to move along and make things happen, regardless of what you're working towards, you better understand that you are competing, and you're going to also take the same principles that you would have had to take with you if you were looking to make a couple of bucks, right? And the idea of just creating a logo and an idea on a website and making things happen is just more or less a fantasy land. It's going to take real maneuvers, and it's going to take real connections. And I think that 2-second statement had that this is effectively a business like any other. It's just classified different than the IRS. I would definitely suggest to anyone who's on day one and not month 13 or 14 that you ensure you have that in the back of your mindset when you start. Otherwise, it's going to be a hard launch.
Yep. Mickey's tired, probably tired of hearing me say this, but I would say, you know, it's just a tax status. It's not a license to lose money.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant thing, actually.
I remember you hearing that on another on another show.
Right.
I really don't have that much to say, you know, Bradley. That's the reason Mickey only has me on every so often.
I will neither confirm nor deny that accusation. So, Bradley, I really got to thank you for taking the time and for being open to this kind of a conversation today. Any other parting questions or thoughts that we can address probably in the next 60 seconds or so?
No, Mickey, I really, really appreciate you having me on. David, thanks for all the inputs as well. It's been great doing this and getting to promote the Canopy Project a little bit. If anyone's looking for us, we're very easy to find, the Canopy Project, nonprofit.org. You can find my contact information on there as well. If anybody's working within tech in the nonprofit, I'm in particular looking for more people with those kind of capabilities to speak with and talk about what we're doing. But again, thanks for doing this type of format with me. It's been great to get to do this, especially after learning more about you and your environment and listening to your guys' backgrounds over the last couple of weeks. So thanks.
Thank you. Dave, thanks for taking the time. I know you're busy, but I really appreciate you doing this with me today.
This is always a lot of fun. And Bradley, thanks for being here with us. Thanks for what you're trying to do. Good, that it's important work and world's lucky to have you.
Thanks, David.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We invite your support of our efforts via Patreon. Please find us at patreon.com/nonprofitsnapcast. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.